T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it, with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. You'll be glad you did.
Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the Radio.com app today.
Would you walk us through a typical day?
Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's.
Stop spending!
I'm president, and you're not.
This is the greatest country in the world, but we do have some really stupid people representing it from time to time.
I am proud to shut down the government. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I don't think he's a smart person, but he's got a loud voice.
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Man, I got to tell you something. I don't know why I did this just a few minutes ago before the show started. I think I was checking on the Mark Reardon Show Facebook page, but I was looking at memories, and it was, I guess, 11 years ago tonight. I went to Washington. I used to go to Washington pretty much every year. Last year, I can't remember if I was there last year. I think I was. Obviously, COVID got involved this year, but went out to see, and I don't even know if he was Speaker Ryan at the time, but my friend, the former congressman, former Speaker Paul Ryan. But I had a picture of John Shimkus. I just sent this to Congressman Shimkus because he played in the congressional basketball game that night. I got to see the game, and that was a lot of fun. I can't believe that was 11 years ago. I also saw a picture on Memories of 4 years ago tonight. Dave, I'm going to put this one on Twitter. It kind of is a gut punch. It is a beautiful and jam-packed Faurot Field in Columbia, Missouri, for what must have been, well, that was probably a Saturday night game, September 17, 2016. But, you know, there are going to be some fans in Memorial Stadium. Did you know that?
I did, yeah. That's crazy to see them play the Crimson Tide here in, what, about a week or so? About 8 days, 9 days?
Yeah. Last time we played the Crimson Tide, I think we left it about 5 minutes into the first quarter, if I remember correctly. That didn't go very well. But look, I think it's going to be fun for fans to be in there, spread apart safely, et cetera. We get rolling here for this Thursday edition of the show. I should mention that, you know, we had a bit of a weird week because yesterday there was baseball and I was doing my show from the parking lot of the Drury Inn. I wish I was making that up. We have baseball tomorrow, so no show tomorrow. Back on Monday. I think we're loaded up Monday through Thursday, and then baseball again on Friday, and we'll see where this season takes us. I think that the showing in Milwaukee was too outstanding, so we'll have John Rooney chime in on some of this a little bit later this afternoon at 4:20. The governor of Missouri, Mike Parson's coming up. Also, David Marcus from The Federalist. David has written a great column about the police killings out there, and I'm talking about the people who are killing the police, not the other way around, and how the Democrats have seemingly ignored a lot of that. But let me tie it in with something here that I ran across earlier today that I thought was very interesting and enlightening, and maybe it will shed a little light on why some of us feel that the social justice decisions that are being made by athletes, by leagues, are somewhat questionable. Now, I'm guessing that there are a fair amount of you out there that don't agree with me on this. But bear with me. Let's just tell me what you think when you hear the facts of this case, okay? And this has to do with the Pittsburgh Steelers. When the Pittsburgh Steelers took the field on Monday night, they played Monday Night Football, they wore the name of Antoine Rose Jr. on the back of their helmets. Most of the players, we'll get to that here in just a second, too. It's a little bit nuanced. So the Pittsburgh Steelers official Twitter account tweeted out, at Steelers, "We don't want him to be forgotten. For the 2020 season, we unite as one and will wear a single name on the back of our helmets, Antoine Rose Jr." And here's what the Post said. This is what the team says is the reason. On the night of June 19th, 2018, the car Antoine Rose Jr., who is black, was a passenger in, was pulled over by the East Pittsburgh police while the driver was being handcuffed on suspicion of being involved in an incident that happened earlier that evening. A frightened Rose, I love that, wait till you hear the details, fled from the car. The cell phone video a bystander captured showed Rose running, and then you could hear gunshots and see as he was fatally shot in the back three times by a white East Pittsburgh police officer. That's the official description by the Pittsburgh Steelers on their Instagram page for Antoine Rose Jr. Okay. Now, much of that is true. Some of that is true, but it's another great example. Red State highlighted this today of how you leave facts out that are pretty valuable, I think, tend to really change the nature of the narrative here. So let's talk about what happened here with the guy that the Pittsburgh Steelers have decided to honor, Antoine Rose Jr. On the afternoon of June 19th, 2018, there was a guy named William Ross. He's walking down a street in his neighborhood in Pittsburgh. It's North Braddock, for those people who know the area. This is all on video. This is how I know this, by the way. There's actual video surveillance evidence of this shooting. So he's walking on the street. Car zips by, starts shooting at him. All right. So a description of the car is broadcast. About 5 minutes later, the white East Pittsburgh police officers see a car matching the description that also had bullet holes. Interesting, right? There's people shooting at each other. This is in broad daylight, by the way. Now, it is unclear whether the holes were created at that incident or, you know, at some other time. That is not clear at this point. But the fact of the matter is it was a call for a shooting. The car met the description, and that was a felony traffic stop. So the officers stopped the guys. The men in the car armed, and they tried to kill someone earlier, right? So here's a couple of descriptions of what happened from a variety of sources. This is from Wikipedia and elsewhere. Tuesday, June 19th, there was a drive-by shooting in North Braddock around 8:30. 10 minutes later, police stopped a car matching witness descriptions of the silver Chevrolet Cruze used in the drive-by shooting. The police observed bullet holes in the side of the car. A video recording taken by a bystander shows police ordering the driver to step out of the car. While the driver is being handcuffed, Rose and the third occupant, Zajrun Hester, ran from the car. Rosefeld fired three rounds, and Rose was struck by all three. He was pronounced dead at McKeesport Hospital. In the video, a woman's voice is heard. Why they shooting at him? All they did was run, and they shooting at them. Police said Rose had been unarmed when he was shot. Hester escaped but was later arrested. So then you have the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette publishing a video showing Rose in the front passenger seat of a Chevy Cruze. Okay, this is the surveillance video. So Rose is the front seat passenger. Hester is in the back seat. He opens the window, starts shooting. Okay? So they say, contradicting that video evidence, drive-by victim William Ross told investigators that Rose was, in fact, the individual who had shot him. The beef was between me and him. That car came by. He shot me. I ran to the store. The DA in Allegheny County says Rose had an empty 9mm handgun magazine in his pocket. Officials stated there were two guns in the car, a 9mm, 40 caliber. Hester had fired the 40 caliber. Trial. Now, this went to trial, by the way, so you're going to get caught up with all this right now. So the white police officers were put on trial. The testimony from a scientist in the medical examiner's office showed Rose had gunshot residue on his hands at the time he was shot. DNA was found on the 9mm pistol found under the passenger seat. During the trial, Rosefeld's attorney, the cop's attorney, claimed that Rose had stolen one of the handguns found in the car during an armed robbery of his employer just hours before he was shot. That was ruled inadmissible by the judge, as information regarding the gun theft was unknown to Rosefeld when he conducted the felony traffic stop. That's good enough. That's fair enough, right? But you have a little bit more details of what happened, okay? Now, you kind of know the story here. So this guy who was shot by the white cops in East Pittsburgh had attempted to murder a guy using a stolen weapon. He was stopped legitimately. He ran from police as he was being arrested. He was shot. The officer was tried for homicide. The white police officer was tried for homicide. The jury deliberated for 3.5 hours. What do you think happened? What do you think? Take a stab at this one. Well, it's because the criminal justice system is in the tank, right? Systemic racism. Now, he's not guilty. There's no racism, systemic or otherwise, in this death. And think about, let's go back to the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Pittsburgh Steelers write this paragraph up. May honor a guy who tried to gun down another guy in the street and was killed because of his own actions. And they want to honor him for the entire season. Now, there's a guy, you might have seen his commercials out there. Alejandro Villanueva. He's a big, burly offensive tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers. They had him featured a couple years ago in a commercial. I can't remember what commercial it was. This guy went to West Point. He was in the 10th Mountain Division and 1st Ranger Battalion. He's won awards for valor. And when Villanueva came out, he covered up that name, Antoine Rose, with tape. And he put some different names of military veterans on his helmet. And I'm told we'll continue to do that. And of course, then you have the stories out there. The Steelers announced the team would honor Antoine Rose, who was killed by a police officer, on their helmets. But Alejandro Villanueva instead honored Alwan Cash, who died of injuries suffered pulling fellow soldiers out of a burning vehicle in Iraq. Look, this is part and parcel of what happens with most of these police shootings, including Mike Brown. The facts of the case rarely get reported. I mean, a couple of questions here I have. Did the Pittsburgh Steelers do this knowing all the facts that I just told you? And are they okay with it? Does any member of the Pittsburgh Steelers who has this name on their helmet know anything about this case? I think the answer is probably no. It happens time and time again. Breonna Taylor is another example. I'll maintain, you know, there was a settlement on that this week. That case had nothing to do with racism. You could say it had to do with police brutality. It didn't have anything to do with racism. There was ample, overwhelming evidence that Breonna Taylor was associated with people who were dealing drugs. Now, nothing was found in her apartment, and I don't think she was a drug dealer. But when the police entered her apartment, her boyfriend started shooting, and then the police fired back. Now, that might be bad police work. As I've told you, I'm not a fan of the no-knock warrants. The police insist they have to have them for the element of surprise. It certainly backfired in this particular case. But the players that want to remember her name, say her name, Breonna Taylor. Do you know anything about that case? Do you know anything, Ben Roethlisberger, about this guy who tried to kill someone on the streets of East Pittsburgh? My guess is no. It's 217 at KMOX.
You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show.
When you're out of my sight, you must constantly Twitter me exactly what you're up to.
Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon, KMOX.
.221. By the way, producer Dave Klein pointed out that Maurice Pouncey from the Pittsburgh Steelers, when he found out details of that case that I just highlighted, also broke from the team and took Antoine Rose's name off of his helmet. So maybe the word got out just a little bit. We're joined this afternoon by the governor of the state of Missouri, Mike Parson. Governor, how are you this afternoon?
Hey, fine, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well. Fair amount of territory, though, to cover here in a very short time. So let's start with the crime special session, which wrapped up yesterday. From the outside, does not look like a big success for you or the Republicans. Would you challenge that assertion?
Yeah, I would. You know, the two main things we really wanted, we wanted the residency in there requirement for St. Louis. That was a big deal to us. The witness protection was probably really one of the main ones, and that was kind of a Kansas City one. So. But they're going to both help with the witness protection all over the state. But look, you don't always hit a home run in the legislature dealing with them. But, you know, at the end of the day, we got things moving forward. There's more tools in the toolboxes than we had before we started. So anything we can do to fight violent crime in this state right now, for me, I believe is a win in whatever category that is.
Okay, so obviously one of the priorities or one of the suggestions that came up was to let the Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, or whoever might be Attorney General, sort of use their office to prosecute some of the cases from the local circuit attorney. That did not move forward. But are some of these ideas that did not advance still something you'd like to see into the next legislative session, providing that you're still governor?
Oh, I definitely so. We want to continue to work on trying to give the tools we need for law enforcement, number one, but for the victims out there. And I hope, even though we didn't pass the legislation, it doesn't keep the prosecutor from asking for help with the AG's office. And I hope maybe that we continue to do that, to find a way to build a relationship where you go after violent criminals, because I think St. Louis now is at 194, somewhere on that, on homicides, and you've only charged about 30-some-odd people with it. And we just got to figure out, we got to do better than that. The victims deserve more than that. The safety of the citizens of St. Louis deserve more than that.
So how are we doing right now in Missouri overall when it comes to COVID? And from this perspective, so I've seen some people out there on Twitter say, look, Missouri is now third in the nation for the most COVID cases per 100,000 in the past 7 days. You're running ads here in St. Louis that, you know, basically say we've done a great job handling the pandemic. Now, I think the death numbers are down. There's a lot of positive things happening right now. But do you still have some concern about some of the rural areas where, you know, down in Farmington or wherever some of the hotspots have been? This has been sort of getting out of control to a certain extent.
Yeah. Well, number one, I don't think it's out of control, but it's a concern every day. It's been a concern for 6 or 7 months now, dealing with it every day. But the reality of it is we know a lot more about this virus than what we did 6 months ago. We're not helpless against it by no means. And when you look at the hospitalization in the state, we know where that is day in, day out on a weekly basis. We know what the testing situation is going from 2,000 to 100,000. And we know that this younger population is driving those numbers up. That 18 to 24-year-old brackets account for about 30 of this. But one of the main things we also know in the 1st of April that the fatality rate in this state was about 7%. Today, it's about 0.3. Again, it's a concern every day with the virus, but the virus is going to be there. We've still got to be able to open the state up on the economy, and we've got to get people back to schools, and we're just going to have to do all the above and keep pushing forward.
All right, and I agree with a lot of that, but you have schools that are still closed. There's been some criticism because you have Bike Fest at the Lake of the Ozarks and tens of thousands potential of people coming into a big tourist area. Is that a smart thing to have right now during a pandemic?
Well, you know, I don't know if smart or not, but I can tell you this. People are just wanting to get out. I mean, there is some virus fatigue, I think, in our state where people were wanting to try to get back and get back out to some normal lifestyle. And I think that's going to continue to be a lot of pressure on a lot of entities as we move forward. Look, people's going to have to take the responsibility. We've said from day one how important it was for to keep the social distancing, wear the mask, personal hygiene, and avoid big crowds. But at the end of the day, people have to take that responsibility or they don't. You know, the government's not going to be able to just mandate and enforce every rule and every regulation.
And I'm not saying that you should do that, but I do think it's a fair question when you have hospitals that have seen some, and I think we're in better shape here in the St. Louis area, thankfully, but in other parts of the state, you've had spikes in patients and you've had cases that have ranked up there with the top tier. So I think, and there's frustration, as you know, with Sam Page and some of the restrictions here in St. Louis County, and I've been frustrated with those. But what you're being challenged by is people saying, look, we have a pretty serious situation. You allow these bike fests and other things to happen. Then what happens in the rural areas, and are we going to make it worse moving forward into the winter, which could be a pretty dark winter?
Well, I think, you know, flu season's come up. We're all concerned about that. But again, when you look at the data that's in the state of Missouri, we know those outstate areas right now are like a Joplin, like a Cape Girardeau, a little bigger municipalities. But if you also look at Kansas City and St. Louis, you see that the trend headed in the right direction. And again, I think you got to see who's driving the spikes in the state of Missouri and what's the risk factor behind that. You know, we wish that number would change, but the reality of it is we do believe it's starting to, you know, get in a better position than what it was when it comes to the seriousness of the virus. But every day you got to keep an eye on it wherever it is. And, yeah, you're exactly right. We keep a good eye on these rural hospitals to make sure that they're not overwhelmed. And there is some backups for that. And we're very familiar with those areas where this is happening and what the plan is if those cases really get out of hand.
And what would that plan be? Because I think we all want normalization. I think we're all waiting to do things that we want to do. But the concern would be, from my perspective, the concern is, all right, we get this sort of rubber band effect where now, and yeah, things are going in a better direction here, St. Louis County, St. Louis City. But then if we start to open up again and we make some mistakes, then it's the whole thing back in this vicious cycle again.
Yeah, I think you got to look at the data from day one, where you're at today on that. Look, I think if those emergency situations would come back in, the one thing we do know, which we did in Florissant, we can build a hospital in 11 days. We can convert a hotel into a hospital in 11 days if we were to need that. But right, the first call with them this week, the Hospital Association of the state is not overwhelmed by no means. And we can handle a uptick in these cases. And if you look where it's been from June, July, and August, and now into September, those numbers are not escalating at near the rate of what the positive rate is. And you got to be able to look at all of that. All those factors come into play. Again, we've been a balanced approach from day one, and we're going to continue to maintain that balanced approach in the state of Missouri.
And I support that, and I think you're doing a fine job managing it, but I had to ask some questions here this afternoon, as I know you understand. Missouri Governor Mike Parson, great to have you on here this afternoon, and enjoy your weekend.
All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Mark.
229. Look, I think the governor is doing the right thing. I think it's important to balance these things and look at everything. And as he pointed out, if we have to swing into action, we swing into action. I mean, everything. I want to watch this Bike Fest thing because so much has been made about Sturgis and, you know, 425,000 people in this study that says it was a super spreader event and all this nonsense. And the Post is going to do the same thing with Bike Fest. It won't matter. They'll find one person that infected somebody else and they'll make it a front page story. I promise. We'll come back here with David Marcus from The Federalist after the news on KMOX.
News Radio 1120, KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals.
John Rooney joins us 4:20 this afternoon to talk a little Cardinals baseball. David Marcus from The Federalist wrote a great column on the police shootings, not the shootings of unarmed black men, but people trying to assassinate police officers, which is also a part of the story. And he highlighted this, Congressman Chip Roy is from Texas, given some numbers out here that are quite stunning.
I'd like for those sitting at home to focus in on this number 43. This number 43, you want to know what this number represents? This number represents the number of law enforcement officers that have been killed thus far in 2020. 43 law enforcement officers that have been killed thus far in 2020, over 40% more than in the same period in 2019. Where's the NBA? Where's the Speaker of the House? That's what I want to know. Where's the Speaker of the House condemning 43 law enforcement officers who have been murdered? Are their names on the back of any jerseys? Or is that just for preening and posturing?
I think it's for printing and posturing. However, I'm told the speaker did say something about violence today. We'll have to follow up on that. David Marcus from The Federalist with us this afternoon wrote about this. Hey, David, how are you? Joining us on the Quiver River Electric guest line.
Doing well, thanks.
You know, obviously, we've been hit pretty hard this summer with David Dorn, and we had Tamaris Bohannon, another officer who was shot just a few weeks ago here in St. Louis. And I know that your column, as I mentioned and played a little audio there from Congressman Roy, points out the math here. 43 law enforcement officers killed so far. That's up 43% from the same period last year, right?
Yes, it is.
David, so where do you think that this is taking us right now? I know you write about Joe Biden and the Democrats and how they've reacted to this, because to a certain extent on a lot of this violence, including what's happened in L.A. this week, there's been a lot of silence, right?
Yes, there's been far too much silence, and there's been something even worse than silence. We know that for months, the Biden campaign and the Democrats in general just ignored the violence in the street until that became politically untenable. And since then, Biden has been sort of walking his way back to sort of condemning the violence. First, he said it was wrong. Then he said it was lawless. Where he seems to have landed is on this notion that he abhors violence on all sides. The problem with this is that the police aren't on a side. The police are on our side. The only way you're not on the side of the police is if you're a criminal. So I really do feel like the inability or the unwillingness of the Democrats to just full-throatedly say, hey, listen, there are a few things worse that you can do than commit an act of violence against a police officer without any buts about it. They need to do that, and they need to do it now, because this is getting worse.
Yeah, well, we've had examples of this even here in St. Louis that I've highlighted with our mayor, Lyda Crewson, who lost her husband to a violent crime. So you would think that she would be someone who would, you know, have a full throttle defense of the police, but they're so afraid of what I still think is a minority of the constituents that hate the police, and they don't have the courage and the guts to stand up to them.
Absolutely. And the other problem with the rhetoric that we're hearing from the left and more broadly from many people in the Democratic Party is this notion that the entire police writ large, every police force, is systemically or inherently racist, as opposed to the reality of the situation, which is that in most of these incidents, you're not even necessarily talking about a bad cop. You're talking about a situation where a police officer has mere seconds to make a decision that also could involve them losing their own lives. And as President Trump has pointed out, those are hard choices. And we sort of want them to be these robots who automatically do the right thing when they've got 5-10 seconds to make a decision. That's not realistic. And since we're the ones they're protecting, they really deserve our support.
You know, David, I did this thing a few years ago here in St. Louis that was very cool. It was something the FBI put on called the Citizens Academy, and we did a bunch of classroom stuff, and then they took us to the range, and we got to have some fun there. But we also did a simulation, and I've said this many times before over the years. I wish that every American could take the simulation that I took with a mass shooting scenario or something else that was happening, and you're the police officer who has to make a very, very quick decision, because it was very, very enlightening. Now, what I think a lot of people would say, though, on the other side is, look, we're beyond the few bad apples argument with cops. We have countless examples here. So this is a widespread problem. And people like David Marcus and Mark Reardon and others, they fail to recognize that.
Well, I mean, that's just not borne out by the facts. I mean, there's some really wonderful scholars like Heather McDonald at the Manhattan Institute and others who have really done deep dives into this. And there isn't really evidence for widespread racism or intentional disparity within police departments. What you unfortunately have are situations where certain minority neighborhoods, often black neighborhoods in large cities, have more crime, therefore have more incidents of police interaction. And that's what really accounts for the disparity. So if we want to tackle the problem, we have to get underneath it, and we have to fix the criminal situations within these neighborhoods. There are plenty of non-white demographics, from South Asians to Asians, to all types of West Indians, you know, who have far lower rates of incidents with the police. So we need to get underneath this problem and fix the underlying problem, not blame it all on the police, you know, whose fault it clearly just isn't.
Yeah, well, and I don't know, you know, the way that this summer's going, I don't know if we'll ever get back to that point. And you pointed out in your column the record number. I don't know why anyone would want to be a cop right now. And, you know, I think we have example after example where there's an automatic assumption, even if a guy comes at you with a knife and threatens you, or maybe even a gun, we've had situations like that, that there's an automatic assumption on the part of many, including the newspaper here in St. Louis and the rest of the media, that the cop did something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, there's two sides of this ledger. If you're going to say, as many mayors across the country are, to cops, you can't use chokeholds, you can't use tear gas, you can't use these sort of non-lethal means, right? Then there's another side to that ledger, which is that the cop is still in danger. So you've got to say something like, all right, if you can't use these means, wait for more backup, right? Wait until there's overwhelming force so that you're not putting yourself in the position of either being killed or having to kill somebody and go to jail for it. The danger of that, of course, is, as we've seen in places like Portland, 911 calls don't get answered. So we're putting our police officers in this impossible position, and I'm squarely with you that I think it would be very hard to convince most people to wear the badge today, and that's a big problem, because we want the best people to want to work that job. It's one of the most important jobs in the world.
I do think it's important, and you know, I get every time I have an interview like this where I focus on the police, I hear from listeners saying, well, you don't, you know, give enough attention to what really is an issue with what African-Americans, minorities face when it comes to the police. One of the things that and maybe that's true because I don't have some of the experiences that they do. But, you know, I know a fair amount of police officers. I'm guessing you might, too. And some things that I think it would be important for those folks to remember is the horrors that these cops roll up upon, including dead children and things like that, bullet-ridden teenagers. And those are things that haunt them for the rest of their life, and that's what they're dealing with on a daily basis in, I wish I could just say, a few neighborhoods, but in my city, it's in a healthy majority of the neighborhoods here in our region.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other idea that we need to disabuse ourselves from is the concept of a routine arrest. There's no such thing as a routine arrest. It can be the most basic situation in the world. But if the person who's being arrested has several warrants and might be looking at going to jail for a significant period of time, even if they're only being arrested for shoplifting, that can turn into a dangerous and even deadly situation every single time the police have an interaction. And so I think we need to remember that there's just no such thing as an easy arrest that you know is going to go exactly the way you think it will.
I'm guessing you would agree, though, that a large portion of what we're seeing with, and this happened with Mike Brown here in Ferguson, as you would imagine, is the media does not seemingly make any attempt to perhaps tell the entire story and to put some of these things, whether it's Jacob Blake or any of the other police incidents, in full context.
Oh, absolutely. The one that really shocked me this summer was the shooting outside the Wendy's in Atlanta, where the assailant had literally stolen the taser from a cop, pointed the taser at the cop, and then the cop shot him. And I mean, when I saw that, and then I saw that they were going to arrest those cops, I just shook my head. I mean, what was that guy supposed to do? Was he supposed to allow himself to get tased in the hopes that the guy would just run away and not decide to go then grab his gun and shoot him? I mean, I don't know what the cops are supposed to do anymore.
Yeah. Well, I guess the answer that a lot of people would have is yes, which is kind of stunning. David Marcus from The Federalist, always great to have you on KMOX. I appreciate it this afternoon.
Thanks, man.
Traffic and weather together every 10 minutes, mornings and afternoons, on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
I've been watching a fair amount of the U.S. Open throughout the course of the day. I'm finally glad, you know, not all these golf tournaments start with the coverage on television. Sometimes they join in the afternoon. You know, the Golf Channel picks up some, but they've had nonstop coverage, which has been great. Our own golf correspondent, Dan Reardon, will join us at 3:35. I want to tie it in. There's a few things that have happened with the pandemic that have been positives, if you will, or I'll give you one example. Bikes have been very popular, as you might imagine, because people are out there cycling. And golf is the same way. We'll chat with Dan about that. I have a fun with audio segment coming up here after 3 o'clock. A bunch of things I didn't get to yesterday because we had a shortened show that I want to touch on. Everything from an awkward moment on Fox with Newt Gingrich to some exchanges in the White House briefing room with Kayleigh McEnany and Caitlin Collins from CNN yesterday. Dave, let's play the cut because I heard this. Oh, I guess it's possible. I've never played golf with President Trump. That would be an experience. We've heard he cheats. Who doesn't? Of course he cheats. We all cheat, right? Unless you're on the PGA. Sometimes people cheat more than others. Anyway, he's on with Clay Travis from OutKick this morning. Clay got an interview with him, and the U.S. Open is at Wingfoot, which is a beautiful, beautiful golf course, and it is tough. I mean, the rough is probably like six inches. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but Dan's going to put it into perspective. And right now, Justin Thomas, I'm not going to give you the leaderboard because I'm a little bit behind, but Justin Thomas, Patrick Reed had a hole-in-one today, doing quite well. But here's the president on, you know, he's played Wingfoot before.
I'd say low 70s. Quite a bit. Low 70s would be what I've been a member there a long time, and I could do pretty well.
Dave Klein, do you think that the president has ever shot a 72, 73, 74 at Wingfoot?
I'm going to say no. If that's the case, he should be playing at Wingfoot right now.
Well, so that's the thing. I have a hard time with it. Now, maybe he was a scratch golfer in the past. You know, he's been a member, as he said, for a long time. So just maybe there's the possibility. I don't know his scorecards, but I'm guessing that that is enhanced just a little bit. I mean, and if that's the case, I shot a 73-74 at Belle Reve the last two times I played there. 256 at the Voice of St. Louis. We'll get a U.S. Open update from Dan Reardon at 3:35 this afternoon on KMOX. Carol has the news, and we're coming back with more fun with audio. Some great stuff after 3 on KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.